Good morning. How are you this morning? I'm glad to hear it, both of you. Hey, well, we're going to have a little fun this morning. We're going to play a little game. Do you like games? You ever play a game in church? Yeah, most of the time when a preacher's preaching, I play connect the dots or tic-tac-toe, right? You know, that's what you normally do. Find 3 to 5 people around you, and we're going to play a game, all right? It's going to be a game up on the screen, a little PowerPoint game. What we want you to do is, in your group of 3 to 5 people, we want you to see if you can come up with the answers to these. We're going to show you a logo, like a corporate logo. You need to see if you can figure out what the slogan is for the logo, all right? Now, we don't have all morning for this game, all right? So we're going to put each logo up for about 15 seconds. And after the logo's up there for about 15 seconds, we are going to the next one. And if you go, oh, no, put that back, well, we're not going to, okay? So you got to move quick. So see the logo, talk with your group, come up with an answer, write it down. Let's see who can come up with who can win our PowerPoint game this morning. And you can feel victorious and good about yourselves because you won a game in church. That's good. All right, so here we go. Did you all get all of them back there? Lying people. 7, 8. You guys got 8?
We got 9.
That's impressive. That's a group of people who watches way too much TV. Did you notice how on some of them, here's the interesting, did you notice how on some of them, they had a logo and a slogan, but for some reason, their advertising has left that, and they've not effectively communicated it, so what they're really known for is something else. The Ford one kind of comes to mind. On others, they definitely have built everything around their slogan, slogan. There you go, their slogan. Actually, a slogan is the combination. It's a real word, believe it or not. But they've built everything around that. So what do you think of Verizon and that kind of stuff? Or Singular, you think raising the bar. And you can see the images of all those bars. Well, the reason we started with this game is because this morning we're going to be wrestling with the question, what is it that we as a church are known for? What is our message? What is the key issue for us? If people around the community and people around, you know, Eureka and other places think of Genesis, what do we want them to be thinking about? And Paul's going to bring this up and help us clarify that. There is one message that we want to be known for, and that is the message of Jesus. We are doing a series of messages titled, What Matters at Genesis? We're a new church. It's important that we really understand who we are, what we're about. And even though we are small in numbers right now, I believe that God is going to use us to reach people in this community, but we better know what we're reaching them for. We better know what our message is. And that's the challenge today. A lot of churches may start with the gospel, the good news of Jesus being their central message, but then all of a sudden they become known for everything else. They're known for certain types of activities or certain types of social action or certain types of things that they preach, maybe politics and things like that. I don't want us to be a church that's known for anything. If people know us in the community, I want them to know us as the place that talks about Jesus and honors him. Because he is central in everything that we are and everything that we do. As we talk about our core values, and that's really what we're going to be doing. We're going to be talking about the core values of our church. Core values are things that we hold dear as central to who we are so that we can live out the mission that God's given us. Last week we talked about the fact that we're going to be a church who's trying to live out the mission of God, the mission of Jesus, equipping people to live their faith in such a way that it's faith that blends into life and people notice it. But if we're going to do that, we better know what our core message is. What is it that we want to be known for? Now, we've got a logo. We've got a slogan. It's a place for new beginnings. Our purpose statement says that we are a place, you know, we exist to help people find a new beginning in Christ and become more like him. But see, the central part of that is this. The only place you find a new beginning, the only place that a person can have a fresh start is in Jesus. And so we had better know what the central message that we have, the message of Jesus, is all about. What I'm telling you this morning, what I'm trying to express to you is that the ideas that we're going to look at out of the scriptures this morning, what will happen in this church is that every single message, every single teaching, every single Bible study or community group, somewhere in the midst of things is going to have the message of Jesus. If you ever go to a church and somebody stands up on this stage or the stage of their church and they begin to preach and teach and talk and they never talk about Jesus, they never bring up Jesus, they never fix your heart on Jesus, they never get you focused on Jesus, I want to tell you that that is not the type of church that is honoring God, because the message of Jesus is the message of the Bible. Every verse points to him. Every story pictures him. Everything about the Bible is about Jesus. And we're going to look at this guy. His name is Paul. Paul was a guy who was a very religious guy. He kept all the rules of the Jewish religion. He had kind of worked his life out in such a way that he was real high up in the Jewish faith. He had a lot of leadership. He was a guy that they called a Pharisee, which he was kind of a guy who, you know, he spent hours every day just reading the Bible and saying, well, how can I keep this rule? And how can I follow this rule? And how can I make sure I do this? And he, in the midst of that, he opposed Christianity wholeheartedly to the point where he persecuted Christians. And he was against Christianity. But one day, Paul's on this road towards a city called Damascus, and this light shines from heaven, and Jesus himself spoke to this guy named Paul. And at that point, Paul realized that Jesus is the answer to everything he was searching for. Paul gives his life to Jesus, spends the rest of his life following Jesus. And he wrote a number of books in the New Testament of the Bible. One of those books is the book of 1 Corinthians. We're going to look at that. If you have your Bibles, we're going to be in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 this morning. If you don't have a Bible this morning, we'd love for you to just take one that's at the end of your row. Pick that up, use it. In that Bible, we will be on page 816. And we will be reading out of 1 Corinthians chapter 2. Paul is talking here to a church that he helped start. He was a church planter for a while, just like what we're doing here. He would go into a city. He would help start a church. Sometimes he would just stay for a few days or a few weeks. In Corinth, in this city where he's writing this book to, he actually stayed as their church planting leader, their church planting pastor, for a year and a half. And he's talking to them about the core message. What is it that was central in what we did, what we preached, what we shared with you, everything that we talked about? And it is the message of Jesus. And so if you have your Bible, we're going to be reading out of 1 Corinthians chapter 2, beginning with verse 1. Paul says, "And I, when I came to you, brothers, did not come proclaiming to you the testimony of God with lofty speech or wisdom." He says, listen, when I came to you. Now, let me tell you the story. What happened? Paul went all over the world. He had just been in Athens. You know, if you remember the Olympic Games a couple years ago, they were in Athens, the great city where all the philosophers, you know, kind of came and gathered, and they would sit around and they would talk and they would come up with new ideas. And he was in Athens for a while, but then he went about 20 miles up the road to the city called Corinth. Corinth was a major seaport. It was a place that it was the Las Vegas of that day. It was a nasty, really a vile city. They had this temple that was kind of on the top of a hill where anywhere you were in town, you just turned that way. You could see the temple. But in that temple that they had, they worshiped the goddess Aphrodite. Well, most of you got to feel a little squirmish or uncomfortable with that right away, because Aphrodite is a goddess of love. And literally what filled that city, this is really weird, their culture, but what filled that city is in this temple, they had all these temple prostitutes, about 1,000 of them, who would come down out of that temple and just fill the city at night. And the way that you would worship their god was to have a sexual relationship with one of the temple prostitutes. Really weird. And Paul goes into this culture and he begins to preach to those people. Paul did like he always did. He went first to the synagogue, the place of Jewish worship, and he began to tell people about Jesus there, but they weren't real crazy about his message. Some people believed, other people got really mad and kind of threw him out. And so one of the people who believed, though, was this guy named Titus Justus, who lived, sometimes God has this great sense of humor. Titus Justus, he had a house right next door to the synagogue. So they'd thrown Paul out, but then Titus says, hey, let's just bring the church to my house. And they start a church in this guy's house right next door to the synagogue. There were others who followed, but Paul started feeling the pressure that he always felt where he was starting being persecuted for the message that he had. And people weren't real crazy about the things that he was doing as he was trying to tell people to love Jesus, trust Jesus, give their life to Jesus. And so he started feeling that. One night he was praying and God spoke to him. And what God said is, listen, I want you to stay here. I don't want you to leave Corinth. I want you to stay here and I want you to preach the message of Jesus because I have a lot of people in this city. It's a very interesting verse because it sounds like there's already a bunch of Christians, but that's not what God is saying to him. What God is saying is that I have a whole bunch of people in this city who are going to trust me. They just don't know it yet. See, God is always in control. God is sovereign. He knows who's going to follow him, who's going to trust him. And what he's telling Paul is, I want you to preach because in this city are a whole bunch of people who are eventually going to turn to me at your preaching. And I want to tell you that that is part of my passion here. I believe that in Eureka, there are a lot of people that are this morning kind of hanging out, watching, you know, the leftover highlights of the Cardinal World Series and watching, football pregames, or they're sleeping or they're doing housework. And God has this incredible plan. He has this purpose. He wants to touch their lives. They just don't know that God is going to do that. And somebody has to take the message of Jesus and tell them about it. That's what we're about. And Paul hears the voice of God and he stays there for a year and a half. And there's a lot of people who give their lives to Christ because of the ministry of Paul. This new church that's meeting in this guy's house. It's right next door to the synagogue. And it's this church that rises up that a lot of them are Jews, but there's a lot of these Greek people who come out of this weird culture, this, you know, just bizarre sexual culture. They give their lives to Jesus, and now they're living out their faith in this community. Paul eventually leaves and he writes this book back to him. And he says, when I came to you with my message, I didn't come looking all cool and with great words and all this kind of stuff. Now, I got to tell you that that's one of the challenges that I have. I want to be cool, except I passed the cool meter about 6 or 7 years ago. Maybe a lot longer than that, but I realized that, you know, up until I was, you know, mid-30s, I still thought I was kind of hip, I was kind of cool, I was kind of in, I was with it, you know. I could get up and be flashy, and, you know, I'd go out and play basketball or play sports with kids, and I'd feel all good about myself. And, you know, now I do that, and first of all, I realize that when I stand in front of you, I'm round. People say get in shape. Round is a shape, okay? But I see myself, and, like, I don't feel cool. I have this gray hair. And I really would like it not to be gray because I just don't think gray is cool. It's hard to be cool with gray hair because no matter how hard you try, teenagers just look at you and go, you look old, you know? And about 5 years ago, this is when it really hit me. I did this whole goatee thing because there was this period of time when you were like working with teenagers where to be cool and in, you had to have a goatee. That was your way of saying, you know, I'm still hip and with it. And my wife likes my hair gray. She likes this. And so I leave it because she's the only one who really matters in my life outside of Jesus. But I looked in the mirror one day, and when I saw myself in the mirror, I realized this was gray. And I was like, oh, dude, cool just doesn't work anymore. You know, it's hard to get up. And Paul, what Paul is saying in verse 1, he's saying, when I came to you, I did not come with all the cool things to say. I didn't fit into culture. I wasn't this hopping hip dude. And when he says that, you need to understand Paul. Paul, history tells us, was a short, bald dude with a unibrow. Okay, he had one eyebrow that went across, but he was balding. He had scars really all over him because he had been beaten, he had been whipped, he had had all kinds of encounters where people persecuted him for his faith. He probably walked a little bit bow-legged, and he probably, you know, wasn't real easy to get around. History also tells us that he may have been, you know, almost blind, so he didn't see real well. He wasn't cool, he wasn't hip, and he wasn't a guy who felt the ability to stand in front of a people and say cool words and be flashy and be wonderful. He just told people about Jesus. He says, when I came to you, I did not come with lofty speech or with wisdom of words. I didn't come with all these great ideas. And he says in verse 1, he says, lofty speech or wisdom. Now that word wisdom is important in this text because from chapter 1, verse 17 until chapter 2, verse 6, the word wisdom is used 14 times. And he's trying to bring up something, and it is this. There are two types of wisdom. In that culture, when they thought wisdom, they thought Plato, Aristotle, Socrates. They thought all the great philosophers, the guys who had new ideas. And he said, listen, I didn't come to you with all these great new ideas that are man's wisdom. I came to you with God's plan. And as we talk about the gospel, sometimes it's hard for us to articulate it. Sometimes it doesn't make sense when we really get into it. And Paul says, I didn't come to you with all these great lofty ideas. I just wanted to tell you the wisdom of God, not the wisdom of man. So often what happens with the gospel is we kind of get it mixed up with worldly wisdom, ideas that come from the world, and it ends up being something that's not quite full. Let me give you some examples. I could have had a list that was just a mile long, but let me give you some examples of things that I think are ways that sometimes we mix the message of Jesus in with other messages. For example, a lot of times people look for the gospel of goodness. This is kind of the message of Jesus that says that if I'm a good person, Jesus is going to be acceptable. He's going to love me and accept me just as I am, and I don't really have to trust him, give my life to him. I'm just a good person. I kind of weigh out the balances. And so what Jesus does is he's kind of like an additive to my fuel tank. You know, you fill your gas with fuel and you put a little bit of that, you know, Prestone stuff in your fuel and it's going to run a little better. And what Jesus is in my life, I'm a good person. I just need to add a little bit of Jesus to my fuel tank so I'm a little better. A lot of people see Christianity and Jesus as just this additive to my life that takes something that's good and makes it a little better. That's not the gospel. How about the gospel of halfway? Which is God did his part, I do my part, and we kind of meet in the middle. You know, this type of gospel sees Jesus as kind of this Tony guru, you know, Tony Robbins guru who's up there going, you can do it. You can do it. Just stick with it. Work harder. Be better. You know, just put more into it. And I've done my part. You just meet me halfway. That's not the gospel. The gospel says it's impossible for us to meet God halfway. And there's a lot of religions out that, you know, call themselves Christians. And what they basically say is you do your part, God did his part, we just meet in the middle and everything's okay. It's not the gospel of the Bible. How about the gospel of right beliefs? I think a lot of times the heritage that I came from, my religious background, this was kind of, if you just check the boxes and believe all the right things, you're okay. You know, if you just hold to the right stuff and you walk down an aisle and you pray the right prayer and you say the right things and you say, yes, I believe in Jesus, everything's okay. And it is important for us to understand what the Bible teaches about Jesus. But just because I believe all the right things about him does not mean that I've met Christ. The Bible tells us that the demons in hell believe Jesus, but it scares the snot out of them because they don't trust him. They believe, they just don't trust him. How about the gospel of tolerance? This is kind of the gospel that says, you know, I just come up with my own set of beliefs and I just add Jesus to the mix. You know, it's okay for you to believe what you want to. I'm going to have my beliefs and nobody can tell me which is right or wrong. Well, the Bible says that God has revealed himself in history and in the scriptures. And so I don't just add Jesus to a list of beliefs. I have to figure out who Jesus is and trust him. How about the gospel of self-esteem? This is a big one. This is kind of the belief that Jesus came and lived on this earth and died to affirm my own self-worth. It's kind of this view that says, you know, I really need to feel good about myself. And the best way to feel good about myself is to realize that I was of such importance that Jesus died for me. It's not the gospel. The gospel said that Jesus died for us when we were still sinners, when we were still worthless, when we still had really no value because of our own heart, and our own wickedness, our own desires. And Jesus gave his life for us not to affirm our self-esteem. He gave his life for us so that we could come to the point that we affirmed his greatness in our life again. The gospel of self-esteem. Another one is maybe the gospel of politics. A lot of churches are known for saying, I trust Jesus, vote for the right person. I trust Jesus, follow the right cause. I trust Jesus, do the right thing. You know, if we can just get the right people in office, if we can get the right people elected, America will be this great Christian nation again. And I want to tell you that I think it's important for us to live out our faith when we vote. I think it's important for us to follow Jesus when we do politics and are involved because we live in a free country that allows for that. But I also want to tell you that the right person in office does not lead to a Christian nation. The right person in power is not the answer. We at Genesis, I'm telling you, there are going to be times where we address some issues because we feel like they're biblical issues. But I do not want to become known as a church that stands for the right person and the right cause at voting time. I want to be known for one message. That's the message of Jesus. That's where Paul's going in this passage. One more, the gospel of social healing. You know, this kind of sees Jesus as this, you know, peasant who wore, you know, poor clothes. It's kind of a hippie. You know, he's got a peace sign around his, you know, wearing tie-dyed shirts, just helping everybody. And that's what Jesus really came for, to be our example of how to help others. And Jesus did that, but that's not the main reason he came. And Paul says, listen, I did not come to you with wisdom of the world. I did not come to you with great ideas. I came to you with one thing. Verse 2, for I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. That's what I want our church to be known. I didn't know anything among you except Jesus and him crucified. He goes on to say, verse 3, and when I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling, and my speech and my message were not in plausible words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power. Paul says, listen, when I preached, when I taught, when I told you a thing, I was afraid, I was trembling, not because he had stage fright, but because he realized that he was standing proclaiming a message that the culture didn't know and understand, and he was overwhelmed at the responsibility he had to proclaim that message. And it's scary. I want to tell you that I go through this every week. As I sit there just before we start our sermon and I pick up my notes and I look through it, I go, oh my gosh, God, I really am supposed to stand in front of a group of people and tell them this? I can't do this. Most of the time, if I don't go through that before a message, I fail miserably because I begin to get up here thinking, I am cool, I'm flashy, I have the right words. And Paul says, listen, when I proclaim Jesus, I didn't know anything among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. And when I stood in front of you, I did it with fear and trembling because I knew of the incredible value of the message I was telling you. And I didn't feel comfortable doing it because I knew that I was frail. But the message is awesome. And he says this, verse 5, he says, because that your faith might not rest in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. He says, when I preached Jesus to you, I was afraid because I didn't want you following me. I wanted you following Jesus. And that's what I want to tell you this morning. Genesis as a whole, as a church, our passion, our desire is that every message is like Paul to say, listen, I came to you, I didn't preach anything except Jesus Christ and him crucified. Jesus Christ and him giving his life for you and for me. That's the message we want to preach. And as we talk this morning, I just want to share with you what that might mean. What is that message when we talk about this? If you're a follower of Jesus, you might understand what I'm saying. Paul says, listen, as I told that, it's a message that sometimes the world doesn't understand. Have you ever wrestled with, you know, sitting down and talking to somebody and trying to explain Jesus? And you say, okay, here's the story. We're like really messed up. We have issues. We've rebelled against God. We follow our own way. And because of that, we're separated from God. But God became a human being. I mean, even that is something that I think sounds weird. Why in the world would God, who is in the heavens, become a man? Why in the world would God, who created all this, come and have to deal with zits and puberty? I mean, why would he do that? Why would he have to put up with people who despised him and didn't like him? Why not just be God? But God became a man in the person of Jesus. And we try to tell people that. We say, and then he died. He died on a cross. It was a nasty, wicked way to die. And we tell people this story, and sometimes, I don't know if you've had this experience, but sometimes as I try to tell the story of the gospel, which is the wisdom of God, I feel like I've got to add to it or make it better so people will get it. And this is what Paul's saying. Paul says, listen, I didn't come with flashy ideas and world's wisdom. I came to you with one message. The message is this, that Jesus came and he was crucified, and that's the story. And real quick, what I want to do is I want to just share with you what that message is really all about. There's four things, four ideas that really flow from this, four truths, four concepts. And what we're saying is that the message of Christ and him crucified announces the good news, first of all, that he lived the life that I should have lived. When we talk about the message of Jesus, when we say we're going to be known for the gospel, we're going to be known for the good news. By the way, anytime you hear me use the word gospel, it is a word from the Bible that means good news. When we talk about the good news of Jesus, the first thing you need to understand is that it is a message that says that Jesus lived the life I should have lived. And we do talk about sin. We have to talk about the fact that I am alienated from God of my own choice. Now, here's the deal. A lot of times we talk about sins, but that's not the big issue. Let me explain what I mean. In our minds, so often we think sin is, I didn't keep the list. Like, I was a bad person, or I didn't go to church, or, you know, I looked at the wrong pictures, or, and those are sins. Those are things that we all have in our lives, but sins are always a symptom of the fact that I am a sinner. And what I mean is, at the heart of it, when God created the first people and when God created you, he created you to honor him and lift him up in your heart. He created you so that the most important thing in your life would be him. That's what God created us for. And when God created us to worship and honor him, we sang the song earlier, you and I were made to worship. You and I were made to be reflections of the beauty and the awesomeness of our God. But we took that and we choose to focus on myself. And instead of God being on the throne as the one to be worshiped, I put myself on the throne. And what sin is, ultimately, it's not the list. It's not all the little things that I do that aren't quite right, that I know in my heart I shouldn't be doing. That's not what sin is, ultimately. Sin is when I put anything in my heart is more important than my walk and knowing God. We all do that. There are every days where I make choices to put myself back on the throne. And the Bible teaches us that because of that, I have a broken relationship with God, that God is perfect, and I have a broken relationship with him because of that, but that God became a man, the God of this universe put on flesh. And it says, I preach nothing to you but Jesus and him crucified. It starts with the fact that Jesus came and lived on this earth. And man, he was born in this little town called Bethlehem, this little girl who was, you know, a teenager, a young teenager, who was a virgin. I mean, that just doesn't make sense. Had a baby. And here in a few months, we're going to celebrate Christmas. But you need to understand, I mean, this story, you know, in a few months, one thing, I don't know if you've seen it, but there's going to be a movie coming out called The Nativity. And they're going to, you know, show us what it might have looked like. And I don't know if the movie's going to be good or not, but they're going to show us what it might have looked like when Jesus was born. But let me put it, if this happened here and now, it would be like some teenage girl from Pacific got pregnant and started going around saying, yes, but I'm a virgin, it's God's kid. You know, and this girl who lived in Pacific went camping in Detmer and had the kid. And a bunch of coon hunters are out, you know, in the middle of the night coon hunting. And all of a sudden these angels start singing to them. And they come back in town going, y'all don't know what we just saw, but it was crazy. We was out there with our lanterns on and there was a coon. We look right past that coon and there they was, man. There was these angels. I mean, that's what happens in Bethlehem. It's a bunch of redneck people. This little girl who's just a young teenager say, listen, I've never been with my boyfriend. It wasn't like that. Well, what is it? It was God, I swear. It's a crazy story. But this little boy who was born, you know, they put him in a feeding trough, grows up and he becomes this man who at times, as you read about him in the Bible, he is so human. He is a carpenter. I mean, he's a guy who works with wood and he knows how to run a saw and sling a hammer and build things. You know, he knows how to do that. He's a fisherman. He's a dude who loves fishing. But it's crazy. When he goes fishing, they always catch a lot of fish. I was watching, you know, the Shark Hunters. Have you seen this? You know, East versus West Coast Shark Hunters. And I was thinking, you know, if Jesus was like on this, I would want him on my team, because the Bible tells us a story. He's out fishing one day and the guys he hung out with hadn't caught anything. I mean, all night long they'd been fishing. Jesus shows up on the shore and says, hey, how'd you guys do? We caught nothing, Jesus. It was a worthless night. And he goes, well, hey, check this out. Just drop your net over on that side of the boat. And they look at him like he's got things coming out of his ears, because they're like, dude, we do this for a job. No fish tonight, not working. The fish are not biting. They're not hanging out here. Our nets are not catching fish. But finally, Peter goes, all right, Jesus, if you say we ought to do it. And they flip the nets over the side of the boat right there on the shore. And there shouldn't be any fish there. And next thing you know, it's like every fish in that whole lake went, like, hey, look, a net. That looks fun. Woohoo! And they swam right into it. And next thing you know, these guys who hadn't caught anything all night have more fish in their nets. They can't even pull them up. The nets are ripping. And they turn, they're like, dude, you are incredible. You must be greater than we are. I mean, it'd be cool. Like, you know, you had him on your shark team. He's like, yeah, fish here. There's sharks, big ones. They know where they are. And they're going to come to your stuff. You know, Jesus, we see him. He's human. But there's other times where we see him and you just know that this guy is something beyond just a normal person. This guy was born blind, spent his whole life, never saw anything. And Jesus had these guys who went around and called him his disciples, and they looked at him and said, Jesus, is this guy blind because he sinned or because his parents sinned? It's like this deep theological question. Is this guy like X'd out because he messed up or because his parents were wicked? And Jesus says, listen, neither. This guy was born blind so that the glory of God might be shown to you. And Jesus does something that's really kind of bizarre. He gets down and gets a bunch of dirt in his hand. He spits in it and makes a mud ball in his hands. And then he walks up to the dude and he like starts smearing mud all over his eyes. And can you imagine everybody standing there going, ew. And he tells the guy, he says, go wash in this pool that's near the temple. And he just walks away. This guy follows Jesus' orders. He goes over, he finds his pool. I think he washes not so much because he thinks something's going to happen. He's got somebody spitting mud all over his face. I mean, it's kind of gross. Even a blind guy could figure that out. And he starts rubbing his eyes out. And next thing you know, he opens. And for the first time in his life, this guy sees. And he's all freaked out. He can't believe he can see. And he's going through the temple going, I can see, I can see. And all the religious leaders weren't real crazy about it because Jesus did it. And they start hounding the guy. Who did this to you? He says, the guy called Jesus. Well, what's he look like? I don't know. I was blind when he was there. I didn't see him. How do I know what he looks like? He just put mud in my eyes and wow. And so they're like, you know, listen, you just need to renounce this. You can't say that Jesus did this to you. And he says the greatest thing. He says, listen, I don't know about this guy. I didn't see him. Yeah, I met him, but I don't know a whole lot about him, but this I do know. I was blind a few minutes ago, and right now I see. We see that this guy who is in flesh is God himself who put on flesh and he hung out with us. The Bible tells us he had three roles that he lived on this earth. He lived the role of a prophet, which means he stood in front of people and he spoke for God. He told us what God was like. He preached God. He pointed us to God. He said, listen, if you want to know what God is like, look at me. He was a priest. A priest is somebody who went to God for the people. So he went to the people for God. He went to God for the people. He was the go-between between us and God the Father who was in heaven. And he was a king, which means he was the one who would reign, and he's coming back to reign someday. Eternally, he's going to be on his throne. And as prophet, priest, and king, he did something that you and I couldn't do. He lived a perfect life. Every time he was presented with an opportunity where he could choose self, honor self, he chose to honor his Father. Every time he was presented with a chance to turn from God and do his own thing, he turned to his Father and trusted him. And see, what we see, what I want you to understand is when you look at Jesus, sometimes we think he is an example for us to follow. And that is true to a point, but I want to tell you, you're never going to get there. But what the Bible really shows us is not that he's an example to follow. He's a substitute that took our place. When I look at God and I stand before God, I have to say, listen, I have turned against you. I've done my own things. I've followed my own way. And because of that, my heart is set against you. But when God looks at Jesus, he realizes that he was perfect and he lived the life that I should have lived. And when we talk about preaching Christ and him crucified, this is one of the heart key things in the message that we're always going to be proclaiming is this, that all I have to offer God is my wickedness, my sin, and my rebellion. And what God does when somebody trusts Christ is he takes my sin, not all the little bad things I've done, that's part of it, but he takes the very heart that I have that says, I want to worship myself. And then he takes the perfection of Christ and he credits that to my account. And so that when somebody trusts Jesus, God looks at them and he no longer sees their selfish ambition to serve self. He sees Christ in their place. I gave my life to Christ when I was 7 years old. I don't get it. I'm not the example to follow. And I'm not the one who took your place for sure. And there's days where I wake up and I know where my heart is and some of my struggles that I have. And I get overwhelmed at the fact that when God sees me, he doesn't see me anymore. He sees his son who was perfect. And he lived the life that I couldn't live. I just couldn't do it. But Jesus came, he lived this perfect life. But the second thing that the gospel always preaches is that he died the death I should have died. He lived the life I should have lived. He died the death I should have died. This guy who was perfect, who honored God in every step of the way, who did everything he wanted his father to do, who lived in front of the people and taught them and was prophet, was priest, was king, was despised by people, was rejected. And they took Jesus on one Friday. They took him up on a hill. And they put him on this stake, this cross. And they used the most, crucifixion is literally the most hideous way that people have come up with for other people to die. It was incredibly painful. When somebody was crucified, they died by asphyxiation, what happened is they would nail their hands and their feet to this board, and they would put them up there in this place for everybody to see. They would strip basically all their clothes off of them, and they would be there suspended between heaven and earth, and the pain would cause muscle spasms, which would lead to the chest, and the muscle spasms in the chest would cause the lungs to begin to fill with fluids. But listen, for some people who died on crosses, it took several days. And they did it in the most public places. I mean, if crucifixion was going to take place today, they'd do it in a Walmart parking lot. You know, it's not like this was off the back road somewhere. They did it in the most public place where everybody walked by and saw these people dying on a cross and would spit at them and laugh at them, make fun of them. And he would, you know, these people would be suspended there in pain. Some would be cursing. Some would try to find ways to ease their pain, and they'd almost try to commit suicide just by leaning forward so their lungs couldn't expand anymore and they couldn't get any more air. And they did this to God. They did this to Jesus, the one who was perfect, who came on our behalf. But here's the thing you need to understand. When he was on that cross, it wasn't about those people who did it to him. He was taking my place. He died in my place. He died the death I should have died. You see, the cross is not ultimately about just the fact they killed this guy and that's it. The cross says that because of my rebellion, because of my desire to serve me, God, who is perfect, had to deal with my rebellion. But instead of putting it on my account, he chose to put Christ's perfection into my account. And he chose to take my rebellion and put it into Jesus. And the Bible talks a lot about wrath. See, this is one of the things that's hard. When we're talking about the gospel, God is a loving God, but God is a God who is also passionately opposed to our selfishness. And God poured all of his wrath, all of his anger, all of his frustration of our sin, all of the stuff that we'd done, and he put it on the back of Jesus. He died the death that I should have died. God took my stuff and put it on his account. It's, you know, early in church history, people started putting crosses up as signs that they were Christians. They would have crosses. The artwork of the early church was filled with crosses. And we've kind of passed that on over the years, and we see that in man, there's all these beautiful images of crosses, and we've kind of lost the edge of it. But I want to tell you that in the Roman world, it would be the equivalent of if we started, you know, putting electric chairs or pictures of the gas chamber in a stained glass window in our front window. Roman culture didn't understand why these whacked out people would put a cross in their window. I mean, it's a place where people are executed. But it was a reminder, listen, Jesus died the death that I should have died. That's who it was. But the third thing I want you to understand is not only did Jesus die the death I should have died, Jesus also won the victory I could never win. Jesus won the victory I could never win. When Jesus died on the cross, he didn't stay there. This week, now you had to know that if you came to church this morning, somewhere in the midst of this, I was going to interject some Cardinals stuff because, hey, did y'all realize that the Cardinals won the World Series? That's right. See, amen. You know, did y'all jump up and down and go crazy and high five everybody in the room? Everybody but the Allens did. They were in mourning because, you know, they, you know, were just their beloved Braves didn't get there. I understand that heartache. But the rest of us, man, and the thing that was so cool about the Cardinals this year, nobody thought they could do it. It was like the unwinnable thing. When, you know, if you were a baseball person and of sane mind, when the Cardinals made the playoffs, which was, you know, by the skin of their teeth the way it was, I kept telling Andy, as we talk, I'm like, Andy, don't get your hopes up. They're not a good team. They're not very good. They're not a good baseball team. They didn't pitch. They didn't hit. And it was like this unwinnable reality. There was just no way that this team could go through and beat San Diego. Wasn't going to happen. Well, then they did. Well, they're going to get killed by the Mets, and then they win. And then you look at the Tigers, and, you know, you go, you know, there's no way. And, you know, the reality is that there was a way, right? You know, and so the possibility of them winning. But the thing is that it was so improbable, it just seemed like it couldn't take place. And we watched this, and I don't know about you, but it took game five of the NLCS before I could even get excited. I just didn't think they could win anything. And next thing I know, they won the World Series. Well, here's the deal. Here's what I want you to understand. They put Jesus in a grave. They had crucified him. They had beaten him. They had pulled his beard out. They had put a crown of thorns. He had died a horrible death on a cross, and he did it for me and you. And he stared at the two issues that you and I can't beat. You and I cannot beat ourselves, and we cannot beat death. It's just not going to happen. Every day I get up and I say, today's the day I'm going to be better. Today's the day I'm going to overcome me. I just can't do it. I don't know about you. Maybe you're more disciplined than I am. There are things in my life I just can't seem to overcome about myself. And you know, it seems like, you know, I don't know if you have this struggle, but if I stay up at night and I'm like having trouble going to sleep, I begin to realize I'm 40, which means I'm more than halfway there. Death is out there, and you can't trick it. You can't beat it. You know, every program on TV this month reminds us that, hey, you're going to die. And hopefully it's not with some guy with a hockey mask or, you know, with long fingers. But the reality is it scares us, and we know that we cannot beat this. But here's the deal. The Bible says that they put Jesus in a grave, and he left him there. And everybody thought that the thing was over, that Jesus had lost. And Jesus looked at our struggle with ourselves and our sin. He looked at our struggle with the grave. And 3 days later, Jesus blew the door off the grave. And as improbable as the victory as the Cardinals was in the World Series, I want to tell you that from a human perspective, a guy beaten death is impossible. But that's the glory of it. He won this victory. And here's the deal. Here's the gospel. Here's the good news. Jesus' promise is that if you trust him and follow him, he will give that victory to you. That's the good news. And the last thing is this, that Jesus lived the life I should have lived, and he died the death I should have died. He won the war that I couldn't win. And the last thing I want you to understand when we say I preach Jesus and him crucified, it is this, that Jesus now lives the life that I can't live. And here's the difference between Christianity and every other religion, that we have a risen Savior who has promised to come live in your life. Galatians chapter 2, verse 20 says, Paul is talking, he said, I've been crucified with Christ. I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. The life I live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. It's no longer when you follow Jesus, how hard I try or how good I can be. It is now a life of trusting Jesus every day. And he changes me from the inside out. It is Christ who lives in me. The risen Jesus places his spirit inside me. I don't know how to explain that, but it's very real. And here's the deal. Every other message of the Bible is connected to that. If I try to go to anything that the Bible asks me, the Bible says a lot of things I ought to be doing and I ought to be living. But if I go to any of those messages, let me give you an example. We talked about Corinth and how messed up sexually it was. It's just a nasty place, and it's kind of like our world today. And a lot of times the church preaches about, you know, sexuality and things like that. We sound like a bunch of prudes because we think God, like, gave us this beautiful thing and then told us, but I really don't want you to enjoy it. It's like a test for you. That wasn't God's plan. The Bible talks a lot about having a wonderful relationship with a person in that way. But then I try. Ooh, I'm going to be disciplined, self-disciplined. I'm just going to win this. And it doesn't work, at least for dudes. I'm telling you, it doesn't work. Or if I'm victorious over it, now I'm self-righteous. I'm better than everybody else because, you know, I wear the true love waits thing, and I've waited for my, and I'm better than you are because I, and now I'm into pride again. I'm worshiping myself, which is the very first sin. And what the Bible teaches us is that in this issue, in every issue, it is letting Christ be in me who he is. He changes me from the inside out. But now when I'm victorious over an issue like sex, I don't get the credit for it. He does. Because I didn't do it. He did. That's what Christianity is. There's a lot of things in the Bible. Kids. You know, we're going to talk to you about parenting. It's got to be tethered to the cross. Why? Because they come out kicking, screaming, and peeing, crying out, this world is my world and I'm the center of it. They need Jesus. And they need parents who will be a picture of that to them. Not a parents who are mostly concerned about keeping a list. And see, that's the deal. And so everything in our preaching is going to be tethered to Jesus and who he is. Jesus Christ, him crucified. The message of the gospel, the good news, I want to tell you, it's a barrier. The Bible, 1 Corinthians chapter 1 deals with this a lot. Paul keeps saying, listen, to the world who doesn't know Jesus, it's a barrier. It's a stumbling block. They are going to choke on this. God who died on a cross, and now I give my life to him, and it's not about my goodness and how hard I try. It's about him. The world isn't going to get this. Our goal as a church is to preach that stumbling block because God has called us to it, but to remove every other barrier up to the gospel, which means that every sermon, we're going to talk about Jesus. If we're talking about parenting, we're going to end up talking about Jesus. If we're talking about sex, we're going to end up talking about Jesus. If we're talking about being a good person on any level, you can't do it, or if you do, you're going to get prideful. It's about Christ in you. Every message, which means every message is going to be a challenge, first of all, to turn to Jesus. That if you don't know him, that you turn and you turn from yourself and you trust him to turn to Jesus. Every message is going to be a challenge to trust Jesus, to get rid of you and your faith in yourself and to trust him. Every message is going to be a challenge, thirdly, to love Jesus, to savor him, to just be passionately crazy about Jesus. And every message is going to be a message to follow Jesus. It is not going to be a message about self-esteem or self-help or being a better person. It's going to be about Jesus Christ, him crucified, him on the cross. And this morning, you might be here and you might be like, wow, I never really heard it like that. I do trust myself and follow myself. Today is a great day just to become a Christian. Trust Jesus. One of the ways that God gave us to remember that is through this thing called communion, where he gave us this ceremony where we remember the blood and the body of Jesus by partaking of bread and some juice that is a symbol of that. It's a reminder that the cross is an awesome thing for those who trust Jesus. And we're going to do that this morning. We're also going to respond in worship. We're going to sing a few songs. And as we sing, those songs are about Jesus. They're not about, hey, I'm going to be a better person. They're about Jesus is it. I'm trusting him. And I worship God now wholeheartedly because I realize how deep he loves me. We're going to have a time where we collect offering. Actually, as you come and take communion, if you have an offering, you can leave it right up here in the basket. But as we take the offering, this is not a time, we're not out to get your money. Really, if you're a guest with us, we don't even want you to give. And if you're part of Genesis, you need to give because it's just a way of saying, God, you've done so much for me, and I'm just responding by trusting you. But we're going to respond this morning. Bands will come out. I'm going to pray. After I pray, they're going to start leading us in singing. As we sing, you just stand and sing with us. When you're ready, we're going to have people down here serving communion. You come down and participate that way. I should come down to center aisle and go to the outsides when you're done. If you have a relationship with Jesus, if you're a follower of Jesus, this is for you. If you've never trusted Christ, today would be a great day. And after the service, I'll be out there, and I'd love to talk to you about that. The message of Jesus and him crucified, that's the message I want us to be known for. Father, we love you, we praise you, thank you for Jesus. Help us worship you and honor you even as we celebrate communion this morning. In your name I pray, amen.